T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11. Tower cleared.
We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Okay, engine stop. CPA at a descent. Hose control, both autos, engine command override off. Engine arm off. 413 is in.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
My guest on Cosmic Perspective Radio is a physician with a specialty in allergies, a longtime space enthusiast, was a college journalist, and was actually the only teenager that received credentials from NASA for the historic Apollo 11 lunar mission. Dr. David Chudwin is here with us today to discuss his new book, I Was a Teenage Space Reporter. Dr. Chudwin, thanks for joining us on Cosmic Perspective Radio.
Andy, it's a pleasure to be with you here today.
You've been a longtime space enthusiast. Your passion for space exploration began at a very early age. Do you recall when and where it all began?
Yes, I recall very clearly. The launch of Sputnik, the first artificial satellite by the Russians in October 1957, ignited a tremendous amount of public interest, and I caught the bug. After Sputnik, I became very interested in space and astronomy.
Sputnik was something that we all kind of woke up to at one time. It's just something that I think sparked everybody's interest. And at the same time, I think as Americans, we were all kind of scared.
Right. I think that Sputnik was a really turning point. And you have to remember that in the 1950s, when I was growing up, was the middle of the Cold War. We did duck and cover drills in schools with the false assumption, I think, that would help us survive a nuclear attack. But it was very real. And the launch of Sputnik by the Russians was a real shock to the American psyche. And the radio sound it transmitted, this beep, 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 was really heard around the world. And it sparked a lot of soul searching in the United States, because this was an affront to the idea that our system was at the best and could accomplish anything. So there was a tremendous amount of public concern and angst at the time whether the United States was falling behind and whether the Russians were gaining the high ground of space.
Yes, and that actually continued. The Russians also then put a person in space in orbit before we did. And of course, we were racing at this point to do that.
If you look at the early space program, one of the things that really stood out was the U.S. had a real deficiency in rocket launchers that would work. And there was launch after launch where the rocket blew up either on the pad or shortly getting off. And so this was a tremendous issue in the early part of the space program, was developing rockets that would not self-destruct.
And at the same time, it seems like the Soviets were way ahead of the game.
It was quite a shock on April 12, 1961, when the Russians put the first man into space, Yuri Gagarin. And I distinctly remember that day. I was 10 years old at the time and came back to the house, and my dad held up a copy of this afternoon newspaper, and the big headline was Man in Space. And this was a total shock. The Soviets were operating in total secrecy, and they didn't announce failures. They didn't announce future schedules. They just announced successes. And this was, again, quite a blow. The U.S. had been working in Project Mercury to get a suborbital space flight, but this had been delayed for quite a while. first by inter-service rivalries between the different launch capabilities in terms of the different military services, and then later with, again, the issues with the rockets and boosters. And it was a great disappointment at the time that the Soviets got there first.
Yes, and I recall that it seemed like every step of the way, the U.S. was behind in the space program. Russians were first to orbit the Earth, first to have a spacewalk, first to put two spacecrafts in tandem, I believe, with each other, or launch one after the other. When did the U.S. start to kind of catch up on all this?
The U.S. was behind until December 1965. With the Gemini 76 mission, the U.S. achieved the first rendezvous in space, active rendezvous in space, when Gemini 6 and 7 capsules came within a foot of each other. And this was a tremendous triumph and the first time that the U.S. started to pull ahead of the Russians.
I remember recalling in your book that you had contacted and had communications with Gemini astronauts during this Gemini program.
Yeah, I corresponded with some of the astronauts, asking some questions and requesting pictures and things like that. For example, one of the most valuable and most precious pieces of memorabilia I have was after Gemini 8, I wrote to Neil Armstrong and Dave Scott. They sent me a packet of NASA photographs and information. I sent back the photograph, and Neil Armstrong inscribed it to me, and this was quite a precious thing.
That's very special. How old were you at the time?
Well, this was in 1966, so I was 16 years old.
You attended high school, and you were interested in journalism, correct?
Right. I got a start in journalism with my high school newspaper, which was called The Torch, and I was one of the editors, and I wrote extensively for it, and I really got a lot of satisfaction out of writing and communicating.
And after high school, you attended the University of Michigan, and you wrote for the campus newspaper.
Yeah, the Michigan Daily is a tremendous institution. It was founded in 1890. And is an independent student-run newspaper at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. And when I started there as a freshman in 1968, I volunteered to join the news staff. And it was interesting because I was the only person in that entire building that had any interest at all in space. Everybody was like a political science major or humanities major, and I was interested in science. I majored in zoology as a pre-med, and also had this great interest in space. So I quickly became the de facto space reporter for the Michigan Daily. In fact, as a freshman in October 1968, when Apollo 7 flew, the first manned Apollo flight, I was able to write an editorial about space exploration for the Michigan Daily. And this was extremely unusual for a freshman to be able to write a editorial. This was usually done by juniors and seniors. And again, it was because I had this special interest in space, which was not shared by most of the other people there.
How does the only college journalist in the world, I mean, not even the United States, receive official NASA credentials to cover such a historic mission?
Now, there were a few other teenagers who were working for other news organizations, you know, for like a television network or stuff like that, but it was very, very few. But I was the only one accredited to cover Apollo 11 for the college press. As such. And the way this happened was in December 1968, a friend of mine and I were talking, and we both shared a longtime interest in space. And we were turning 18 in the summer, and he suggested to me, why don't we go down to the Cape to see a Saturn V launch? And I said, that sounds like a great idea. So I started looking into it, and I realized that if we had press passes, that it would open all kinds of access to us. So I proposed this to the senior editors at the Michigan Daily, and they agreed, but they said I would have to pay for the trip myself. They weren't about to pay for the expenses for a space launch. And then also after that, then the issue was getting NASA credentials. And this was the really hard part. It was difficult because NASA normally did not give accreditation at the time to college journalists because they considered them students. And secondly, they had over 3,500 requests for press credentials for Apollo 11. This was an unprecedented number. To make a long story short, a senior editor of the Daily, a guy named Jim Heck, worked in Washington for the College Press Service that summer. College Press Service was a group of over 500 college and university newspapers. He actually went to NASA Public Affairs Office and argued the case that I would not be representing the Michigan Daily, but all of the college press. Apparently, he was very persuasive because about a month before the launch, I was sent a press badge and press credentials and information.
So you were able to get some sum of money to get airfare, lodging, to cover the event.
Well, I had saved up some money from previous summer jobs, and plus I had some ideas on how to do it. Plus, you have to realize then that the dollar was quite different then. For example, my airfare round trip from Chicago to the Melbourne airport in Florida was $93.50, and the motel rate was $10 a night. And so the dollar was a little bit different then. And then I also had some ideas about possibly writing an article, a freelance article about the experience and selling that, which ended up paying for part of the cost of the trip.
Even though this seems like small amounts of money, that was probably a big amount of money for you as a college student. And what amazes me is that you're able to take the trip. When you went to Florida, how long before pre-launch were you able to cover the event?
Well, I turned 19 on July 11th, 1969. 2 days later, on July 13th, my friend and I flew down there, and it was a very interesting trip getting to Florida. We were at the Chicago O'Hare Airport, and we saw an older woman in line in front of us, and she looked very familiar. It turned out it was Mrs. Rose Cernan, Gene Cernan's mother, and we had recognized her from previous events when Cernan had come back to Chicago after his Gemini 9 flight. So we talked a little bit with her before the plane took off. When we landed in Florida, and again, this was July 13th, 3 days before the launch, we found out that she was coming there to view the launch. When we landed, her son, Gene Cernan, was busy doing other stuff, so Alan Bean was sent to pick her up. And he was at the airport there with her, along with Charlie Duke, and Jim Irwin and Bruce McCandless. So just on landing in the airport, we ran into four astronauts, three of whom would later walk on the moon.
You had some experiences during the pre-launch coverage of the Apollo mission. You got to meet some very interesting people.
The 3 days before the Apollo 11 launch were perhaps the three most magical days of my life. With these press credentials, we were able to go on special tours that took us within 2,000 feet of the Apollo 11 rocket, that took us inside and to the top of the vehicle assembly building of the Launch Control Center. We got to go on the floor of the Launch Control Center, the firing room that wasn't being used right then, and actually sit at the consoles of the launch director. But besides that aspect of it, we attended news conferences and had a special interview. The news conferences were with the heads of the NASA centers involved. So I was just 10 or 15 feet away from Wernher von Braun, Kurt Debus, the head of KSC, Robert Gilruth, the head of the Manned Spacecraft Center, these giants of space exploration, and I was in the same room with them during this press conference. Another press conference we went to had all the top Apollo officials, including George Lowe and Deke Slayton, the head of the astronauts, Charles Berry, the astronaut physician, and we were able to actually briefly talk to them. And one of the most special parts of the trip was a 20-minute private interview with Dr. George Miller, who is really one of the unsung heroes of the space program. George Miller, who just passed away a couple of years ago, was the head of the manned space program. He was the associate administrator for manned spaceflight, and we had a special 20-minute private interview with him in his motel room, and we're able to ask him about the future of the space program. And it was this interview that led to an article that I wrote that helped pay for the trip.
What I think is very special about all this is that you experienced and met so many people in this short period of time, just in the first 2 days, than most people actually meet or experience or talk to in their whole careers.
Right. It was like I've likened the Apollo 11 launch to the Super Bowl of space. You know, at the Super Bowl, all the bigwigs from entertainment, from industry, from all fields of life all go to the Super Bowl. Well, Apollo 11 was kind of the Super Bowl of space. I mean, everybody who was anybody in terms of space exploration was there. And it was a tremendous opportunity to meet people. Just a couple of stories. We took a little walk near the NASA Apollo News Center, which was a building along Highway A1A in Cape Canaveral. And we walked, and that was kitty corner to the Cape Kennedy Hilton. So we took a walk through there, and we walked by the swimming pool, and Walter Cronkite, the CBS newsman, is sitting there at the side of the pool in a lounge chair, kind of holding court with all these people around him. We also went to a kind of infamous bar called the Mousetrap. At that time, 18-year-olds could drink. And we saw a couple of astronauts there, including Bruce McCandless, at the Mousetrap.
In my own experiences, and I don't usually talk too much on the radio about my stuff, but I did go to the last space shuttle launch and did meet a lot of people. But it just can't compare at all to what you did in those few days, an amazing thing. What also amazes me is this, going as media myself to the last space shuttle launch, I mean, I have the technology that we have today. I mean, right now I'm recording this show in our studio on my laptop and also backing it up. I've got all the stuff. I can edit. I can do all these things. And in the days of landline telephones, tape recorders, pencils and paper, cameras using film, you must have had quite a challenge. You just couldn't just pick up a cell phone or send an email to someone to report your story.
Right. Journalism was very, very different then because of the lack of technology. So, for example, to write my story for the College Press Service and Michigan Daily, I went to the second floor newsroom in this special news center, and they had long rows with manual typewriters on them. So I would sit down and type out a story on this manual typewriter and then edit it with a pencil. There was no word processors or anything then, so you just wrote it out on paper. And we didn't have any way of transmitting the story. The larger journalistic institutions had teletype, but to actually send the story to the Michigan Daily, I had to go and use a rotary telephone and phone in the story. In other words, talk to someone on the other line and dictate it word for word, and they would type out at the other end the text of the story. And this seems like so quaint and outmoded now, but that was the only way we had to do it.
Launch day must have been quite an experience. Can you tell us a little bit about launch day?
The launch date, again, was one of the most remarkable days of my life. We got up around 4:30 in the morning and took a NASA bus inside the Kennedy Space Center to the area just outside what's called the Armstrong ONC building today, but then was called the Manned Spacecraft Operations Building. And there was an area roped off for the press, and we ran from the buses to get the best position along the ropes. It was like a rugby scrum. We got places in the third row and just stood there. And around 6:30 in the morning, the astronauts had finished getting suited up and eating their breakfast and started what was called the walkout. And this was them walking from the entrance to the MSOB to the Astrovan that would take them to Launch Pad 39. So we stood there, and I had the experience of actually seeing the Apollo 11 crew take the last steps on Earth before leaving for the moon. And it was a very exciting and emotional experience. I took pictures as quick as I could, but I had an old-fashioned manual camera, and there were no digital cameras. Then you had to wait until the film was developed. So I didn't know whether the film from the walkout was going to turn out for over 2 weeks until I got back home and had the film developed. And luckily, I was able to get some great pictures of the astronauts walking out, and these pictures are included in my book. And then after that, we got stuck in a huge traffic jam, because there were over 1 million people in the area. And even though we were within the Kennedy Space Center, there was a huge traffic jam there too, but eventually got to the press site for Launch Pad 39. But we saw that there was a bus that was leaving the press site going to what was called the VIP site, where all the dignitaries were going to be. So I jumped on the bus and ended up in the VIP site from where I watched the launch. And it was an incredible experience, people watching there prior to the launch, because there were all kinds of people from all walks of life there. There were entertainers like Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon. There were actors like Hugh O'Brien. There was former NASA Administrator Jim Webb. And there was President and Mrs. Lyndon Johnson were there. Johnson was out of office by then, but he had been kind of the godfather of the space program. And he received big cheers when he went to his spot in the grandstands. So prior to the launch, people watched and talked to people. The launch itself was an incredible experience. Months previously, the launch target date and time had been set at 9:32 a.m. Eastern Time on July 16th. There was just a very brief launch window because the spacecraft had to get to the moon with certain shadows from the sun that would make landing easier. So the countdown went along very smoothly. It was warm, a little bit humid. There was a bright blue sky with scattered clouds. Right on the precise moment, there was a dot of yellow flame at the base of the rocket. We were 3.5 miles away from the rocket, and all of the other, the VAB and the Launch Control Center were all that distance away because that's the closest you could get and not have certain injury and death if the rocket exploded. So we were 3.5 miles away, but the rocket was clearly visible. So right on the precise time, there was a yellow dot at the base of the rocket, and then flames shot out hundreds of feet on each side of the rocket, and the rocket just sat there. And it seemed to us at the time that it was just sitting there forever, and I was really concerned that there was something amiss. But then very gradually, it elevated up. But it took a full 10 seconds for the Saturn V to actually clear the launch tower. This is different than the shuttle, which once the solids lit off, got off pretty quickly. And so it very gradually rose up, and there was flame shooting from it. There was a lot of smoke on either side of it, and it was totally silent for the first few seconds. And then suddenly the sound waves hit us. The launch was a physical sensation. There were sound waves pounding against our chests. There was vibration in the ground from this 7.5 million pounds of thrust. And as the rocket got higher, we could actually feel some heat from the 5 F1 engines that were putting out this tremendous amount of thrust. It was a very, very sensual experience with vibration, with these sound waves actually hitting us, and with this incredibly loud noise.
As I said, my experience is only a space shuttle launch, which was pretty inspiring also. And I was about as close as you were, about 3 miles or so. The feeling that you get with this sound bouncing off of you, and this is a smaller rocket compared to a Saturn V. A Saturn V is the most powerful rocket ever made by man, and even today is still the most powerful. To have that experience and feel that is amazing. And the other thing I realized, too, is that you had mentioned that it seemed like forever for the spacecraft to get off the launch pad, the Saturn V. And I've only listened to a lot of the audio, and when they say that you cleared the tower, it did seem like an awful long time. And now I finally realized that this huge rocket with all this fuel in it took that long just to get it off the launch pad and clear the tower. An amazing event.
The two surprising things to me were that it took so long to rise up and clear the tower, because you think about a rocket blasting off. Well, this didn't blast off. It kind of lumbered off, but then gradually gained speed. And the second thing was the intensity of the sound, vibration, and heat. I never expected that. It would be so intense.
After the launch, there were a few days between the launch and the actual landing. Did you stay at the Cape to cover the lunar landing?
Yeah, I decided to extend the trip and stay there for the landing on the moon. Now, most of the people in the press had flown to Houston, where Mission Control was located. But again, I didn't have the funds. I had a very low-budget operation, so I couldn't fly to Houston. So I stayed at the Cape and then experienced the lunar landing from the NASA press center in Cape Canaveral.
Your thoughts on the lunar landing? This is an incredible experience. And you witnessed it. What were your thoughts when you witnessed this landing?
Well, the landing, no one knew what to expect. And the more I learned and read about it, the more risky I understood that it was going to be. Apollo 10, the flight before, had been a dress rehearsal for it, but only came within about 50,000 feet of the lunar surface. And the landing was going to be difficult. And it turned out to be more difficult than anybody even expected. There were several problems during the actual landing, and especially during the last 10 or 12 minutes of it. Neil Armstrong was at the controls, and Buzz Aldrin was serving as the flight engineer of the lunar module Eagle as they headed to the lunar surface. And like I said, there were problems. One of the problems was there were communication issues with Earth, and Aldrin had to work heavily to make sure that the antenna dish was pointed correctly. Another problem that they had were these computer alarms. The Apollo guidance computer that they used was very, very primitive. Anybody's cell phone now has much more capability than the Apollo guidance computer. And the computer got overloaded and started sending off program alarms. And if the computer wasn't working, they would have had to abort the mission. And luckily, there were some people in mission control who were familiar with these alarms and told them to press on. Another problem was that Armstrong was targeted and heading towards a big field of boulders. They didn't have high-resolution maps, and if the lunar module struck a boulder or landed on an uneven area, it could tip over, and that would doom them. So Armstrong had to fly long to avoid a boulder field and avoid a small crater. And then the final danger was that he was going to actually run out of fuel. And at one point, Capcom astronaut Charlie Duke called out 30 seconds, which meant that they had to land within 30 seconds or they would run out of fuel. So all this was going on at the time. And it's interesting that before the mission, that the astronauts and NASA officials said that they only had a 50-50 chance of a complete success on the first attempt. In other words, that they would be able to land and safely get off. And so there was a lot of tension. And I think to me, a common mistake is to talk about the first step on the moon. I don't think that it was anywhere near as exciting or as important as the actual landing. Neil Armstrong did a magnificent job of piloting and showed why he had been chosen to pilot the first attempt at landing on the moon. It was a very, very difficult piloting job. And the fact that it turned out okay was a real tribute to Armstrong.
And mission control made it sound so easy. I had no idea what kind of danger the astronauts were in at the time. They made it seem very seamless.
As I did research for this book that I wrote, I was a teenage space reporter, I realized more and more how difficult it had been and how close they could have come to a disaster on that first landing, because there were so many unknowns and so many possibilities for things to go wrong. And so I got very emotional when they actually landed on the moon and Armstrong said, "Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed." And to me, that was like the ultimate part of this mission, not so much walking on the moon. And I got a little bit teary-eyed at the time, both out of joy at their success, but also remembering all the people that had made sacrifices to get us to the moon, the crew of Apollo 1, Grissom, White, and Chaffee, who perished in a ground test fire. I thought of President Kennedy, who set the goal of landing on the moon, a very bold move. And so it was very emotional for me sitting at the Apollo 11 News Center in Cape Canaveral to realize what had just happened.
I heard Neil Armstrong talk a few years later. He was asked, "What is the first thing you thought of when you landed on the moon?" Not stepped on the moon, as you said, landed. And he said, "We did it. We all did it." And I thought that was amazing. The 400,000 people that were responsible for putting a man on the moon. You know, we all don't realize that.
The astronauts were the visible aspects of Apollo and of subsequent missions, but they're just people at the top of the pyramid of tens and hundreds of thousands of scientists, engineers, technicians, administrators who've gotten us into space. And I think that it's important that we see that in perspective, that the astronauts are kind of the rock stars, but they're not by far the only people who are responsible. For example, all of the people in mission control in Houston played a key role. And the architects of Apollo, people like Wernher von Braun, Robert Gilruth, George Miller, people like George Lowe, that these individuals are as much responsible for the success of Apollo as the astronauts.
Yes, from the people that sewed the spacesuits and the people that... I actually had a good friend whose father was subcontracted by Grumman to make the legs for the lunar lander. So it's just amazing how many people were involved. And Neil Armstrong just giving credit to everyone for landing on the moon. A few days later is when the landing was, and that was in the Pacific. Did you stay at the Cape to cover the landing?
I flew back to Chicago the day after the landing because I had to get back to my summer job. When I took this summer job, it was selling men's clothing on Michigan Avenue in Chicago, and I was only allowed a week off. And it's interesting that before the launch, when we were figuring out what to do, I had a choice to make. I heard about this rock music festival that was going to be occurring in New York in August, which later came to be known as Woodstock. And so I had a choice to take my week off for Apollo 11 or for Woodstock. So whether it was for space or rock music, I think I made the right decision in retrospect, even though there was no other music festival since then like Woodstock. So, I was back home when they landed in the Pacific, back working at my my job. But I had one other encounter with the Apollo 11 crew that summer. On August 13th, they were released from isolation, and President Nixon orchestrated this wild day for them where they went to parades in New York in the morning, in Chicago in the afternoon, and then to L.A. in California in the evening, where he presented them with the U.S. Medal of Freedom Award. And so I was able to see the crew again on August 13th in the afternoon in Chicago, and covered that parade in which over a million people greeted them.
And you also later had the opportunity to meet all three Apollo 11 astronauts.
Yes, I was at three events where Neil Armstrong was there. At the time, he had received a kind of almost mythic status and was surrounded by people the moment he walked into these anniversary dinners. So I didn't get a picture with him, but I was able to see him and hear him in person. But with Buzz Aldrin and Mike Collins, I actually was able to have dinner with them at a couple of space events since then. And this was a tremendous opportunity for me to personally talk to them, show them some of my pictures that I took in 69, and see what they were doing.
Being through this historic event and then connecting with each astronaut, that must have been quite an experience.
Especially a pleasure for me to have dinner with Mike Collins, because I have tremendous admiration for him. And I had always said, because he's such an interesting guy, a Renaissance man, that if there was any astronaut I'd like to have a meal with, it would be Mike Collins. Well, I was able to do that a couple of years ago at Space Fest, which is this annual meeting in Tucson. And it was just absolutely magical to be able to sit next to him at this table and discuss things with him.
In your book, you also wrote about the future of space exploration. Most people know about the U.S. and Russian, European space programs, but there are many other countries that have space programs, and including private companies.
The future of space is bright. Until a few years ago, I was pessimistic about the future in space, but I'm optimistic now because of two things. First of all is international cooperation. And the International Space Station is an example of this, where other countries provided different modules, crew members, and also, in the case of the Russians, also joint control of the International Space Station. This greatly reduced the costs for the United States. I think it's important to realize that at the height of the Apollo program in 1966, the NASA budget was the equivalent in 2018 dollars of $44 billion. Now it's about $20 billion. So we're running a space program with less than half the resources that were available in the mid-60s. And so this lack of money, even though $20 billion is a large amount of money, but this relative lack of money has affected what the U.S. can do. But international cooperation has helped. And then the second big development has been money from private industry. And the two best examples of that are Jeff Bezos, who founded Amazon, has funded $1 billion a year of his own money into a company called Blue Origin, which is going to launch the first space tourists within the next year and are developing a new orbital rocket called New Glenn. The other example is SpaceX, which is founded by Elon Musk, and this has developed a series of rockets, including Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy, and which are eventually going to be used to launch humans into space. So the combination of international cooperation and private enterprise has really augmented what is possible in space.
NASA is now talking about going back to landing humans on the moon by 2024 and eventually going to Mars. Your thoughts on this?
I think it's admirable that a goal has finally been set, because there have been amorphous plans to return to the moon and go to Mars. But as President Kennedy showed, you need to set some sort of deadline. Now, the 2024 goal may be a little bit over-optimistic, but I'm very happy that we have a goal to work towards, whether we make it or not. You know, whether it's 2024 or 2026 really doesn't make that much difference, as long as we have a clear, enunciated goal rather than just amorphous plans.
I have one last question for you, Dr. Chudwin. You decided not to pursue journalism and decided in a career in medicine instead. Was that a difficult decision for you to make after covering such an historic event like the Apollo 11 moon landing?
Yes, it was very difficult to decide between medicine and journalism because I really had prepared well for both. I was a journalism practitioner, but I was also had a bachelor's degree in zoology in pre-med. One of my favorite sayings by the late baseball player Yogi Berra was, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. And so my senior year, I was forced to take a fork and decide between journalism and medicine. I decided to go into medicine, but that I would continue writing. And I have articles through the years, but this book is a result of that latent desire to be a journalist.
Well, it's very special to be able to have two passions, one in medicine, of course, and one in the space program. Dr. Chudwin, thanks so much for sharing your experience, I should say your experience of a lifetime with us, covering the Apollo 11 moon landing, and of course, your lifelong passion for space exploration. Thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Where can our listeners go to find out more about your book?
The book is available on all the online websites, both in the U.S. and in the United Kingdom as well. And it's also available in some brick-and-mortar Barnes & Noble stores. Also, I have a new website that's under construction, and the website is davidchudwin.com. So David, C-H-U-D-W-I-N.com. And there's more information there about the book, including a bunch of the illustrations that were left out.
Dr. Chudwin, thanks so much again for being with us. Greatly appreciated.
You're welcome, Andy. Thank you.
Cosmic Perspective Radio is an Andy Paneros production.